Go snatch me down my turtle shell, for I'm off to see my darling in hell.
Really, really slowly.
It's whores and rum, and get really dumb, this old man will die young, oh. So turtle shell, take me right to hell, to see my sweet old lass. But not before I hit the floor, drowned by drink and ass.
Really, really slowly.
Hello, all you delicious cake-covered wolves who think horror is sweet. I am Cake Wolf, and I am joined in today's show of Bloody Confectionery Delights with Miss Cake Bitch.
Hello.
So, if you are a new listener, we are a horror podcast that builds cakes. Today's icing is a discussion about what we've been doing in horror that includes Steve Alten's Meg and 2017's The Ritual. And then we've got a song by Barnes & Barnes called Fish Heads coming at you. Then we will go into our filling, which will be a discussion on A Monster in My Pocket. Today we're talking about The Hanover. And then we're going to talk about whether romance has a place in horror. So lastly is our crumbs, where we are going to read you some fishy stories that I've written. And you just heard one of the shitty sea shanties.
Yeah.
Can you say that fast?
No.
Shitty sea shanty. I can't.
There's too many rhymes.
Shitty sea shanty.
Anyway.
Yeah, so we'll be throwing that at you. And yeah, fish and romance is on today's menu. That's what we got for you. So let's kick it off with discussing 2017's The Ritual. This was something that you and I both watched together, Miss Cake Bitch.
Yeah,
and,
you started it.
I loved it.
You started it, and I said, mm-hmm. Oh, that was one I wanted to see. So you started it again, mm-hmm. And then I didn't realize that you restarted it, so I wasn't mm-hmm. paying attention
because
I thought you were finishing it, and then you had to restart it again.
Yeah.
So we
lots
watched
of
it.
Restarting.
You watched it like 2.5 times, mm-hmm. maybe almost 3, actually.
I watched it a few times. We restarted mm-hmm. it. We've also restarted this podcast that we're recording right now.
Yeah, this is take 570 million.
yeah, for reasons. Reasons. I actually did not mind restarting The Ritual. It's actually...
You probably picked up a bunch of little things that I didn't notice.
For sure, yeah. So the movie starts off with a character who's going to a convenience store with his best friend. They're both in discussion about how they're going to spend their vacation. And the friend wants to go to Sweden. The other guy's not really into backpacking. They quickly find themselves in a robbery situation. And the dude who wants to go to Sweden just kind of stands there in the aisle while his buddy hides behind one of the racks of booze.
Yeah.
And while the dude is hiding there, he grabs one of the bottles of booze, like he's going to go to war with a fucking glass mace.
Yeah, he's trying to figure it out.
But instead, he's just, like, puckering his butthole and, like, thinking about what he's going to make for dinner that night.
Well, he could have been trying to think of a strategy. We don't have to go there.
Right.
He was probably trying to figure out now, okay, how do I do it?
Yeah, how do I swing this at somebody's head or shove it up their ass? Is he like doing math in his head? Like
he's probably trying to figure out how to do
the shortest distance
himself.
From a glass bottle of vodka to a thug's anus. Yeah, probably. I mean, he's put into an intense situation, and nobody's going to know how they react to a tense situation until they're put into it, until they're faced with that. Nobody can say, "Oh, yeah, if there was gunfire, I would just run in there, even if I didn't have a gun." I'm the president.
Yeah.
Let
me crawl out of this golf dune.
Yeah, nobody knows. And I think this movie conveys that very well. Dude is obviously stressed. He loves his friend. Prior to this scene, they're all at a bar, all of the friends. And
it's a group of them.
Yeah, jovial with one another. And you can tell that they've been together for quite some time. These aren't new buddies. They're buddies of old. And it's sad to see his friend get murdered because his friend won't give up a wedding ring.
Right. So, moral of the story, if somebody says, give me your wedding ring, you give them the fucking wedding
ring. You give them whatever they want. If they say, give me your foreskin, I want to make a wedding ring out of it, give them that too. Just be
if you don't have a foreskin because you've been circumcised.
Well, then you're going to have to give them a little bit of something. Just do a makeshift.
Here, take my pinky.
Do a makeshift moil. Do what you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from there, they go backpacking in Sweden like their buddy had wanted to. And from here, it feels kind of like Blair Witch because they're running into these signs of what seems like witchcraft throughout the woods. And it progresses as they're slowly hit with this like guerrilla kind of warfare tactic where one of them goes missing and then another.
Yeah, another one.
As they progressively disappearing... we're getting to know more of what's happening. And what's behind it is a cult that basically worships one of Loki's children, a Jotun, J-O-T-T-U-N. I always thought they were called Jotun. But this is basically... Loki always had either really hideous or really beautiful children. Now, I think this thing kind of looks majestic in its own way.
Yeah, it's hideous, but
mm-hmm.
in this, like... wonderful way that you can't look away, although you never really get a full picture of it.
This is the highlight of the movie, the monster. It's like this giant deer thing, huge antlers, but it has an upside down human torso coming down from its jowls.
Yeah, it's got human hands.
Yeah, with arms and human hands, and it has this cavity within its within its cranium somewhere, and it just kind of like goes down into these depths where these two yellow orbs kind of peer out from. It's very cool and creepy.
Yeah, I love the monster.
He also has telepathy powers. So we've got this interesting amalgamation of the woods that the characters are running through and a pairing of things that are basically haunting them in their life to kind of make them more susceptible to the beast's attack. So the dude who was suffering from his experience in the convenience store, he keeps seeing like aisles of booze in the woods.
Yeah, he keeps coming across the convenience
interesting.
Store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. And I think that the movie is definitely something that you should go watch if you're a fan of horror. Even if the story doesn't really grab you for its first like 40-minute run, because there is a lot of build up, just hold in there, because once you get to the monster, that's your payoff.
Yeah, the monster.
The cult
great.
Behind it is great too, and there's a lot of lore that they're digging into from Norse mythos and putting into a modern day setting. That's something I can really appreciate because it's bizarre as fuck.
See, and I kind of read the cult as a kind of Swedish hillbilly cult.
Okay, yeah.
Also, I think I want to mention that when you say Blair Witch, it's really just the witchcraft that you're discussing and not the recording.
No, it's not. It's not a POV movie.
Right.
No.
But is this like a trend in horror lately to do the facing of your nightmares thing? I feel like that's been in a lot of movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the newer movies of this. I mean, I say 2017's The Ritual, but it just came out. So, take that for what you will.
I mean, it's fun. I would still watch it, even just for the monster. But and I mean, it wasn't like stupid the way they did these nightmares. They incorporated the woods and all of that, but it just seemed like that's something that seems to be getting a lot of play lately.
Yeah, there was that Thomas Jane movie that we watched where he adopts a child who can make his dreams come real.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe it's just an analogy for everyone who feels like they are currently living a nightmare. Maybe that's what's happening right now. People
maybe
are
that's
just
what
making
it is.
Movies
well, a lot of
where
people...
we're living our nightmares.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people are definitely not happy, and I do believe that film definitely follows inspiration from its point of origin and, standing in history. You look at the Godzilla movies, and right from the very start, the first movie is kind of taking inspiration from Hiroshima.
Right. Nuclear
and
disasters.
They just kind of themed the Godzilla movies after, you know, points in their history and kind of drew relative lines to that. I think that can go to say for, you know, these movies that we're watching that are having an impact on our lives for a reason. I think they're coming at us for
art never happens in a vacuum. Like, there's always something that influences it. It was just a trend that I've noticed, that there seems to be a lot of the living your nightmare.
That's the trend of influence right now. The influenza that's going around.
Okay.
the influenza. But yeah, it's a good point. I didn't pick up on that, but I can see. Yeah.
It's kind of like how Netflix does all of their originals beginnings the same way. They got this like real dramatic music and close-ups of images on black backgrounds, and then there's some drippy something, and so it's just a trend.
I watched a movie by myself without you. This was Blood Bride from 1980. This is also known as Death Nun.
Oh, boy.
Nun as in N-U-N, as in Catholicism.
I'm glad you're watching these without me.
I'm enjoying the nunsploitations.
I am not.
This one from 1980, I believe, was a made-for-TV in the UK. It's actually surprisingly good, and I would suggest you watch this with me sometime. So we have a woman who's unable to find a dude. A dude who's interested in her instantly. Love at first sight. But for the wrong reasons. She's a dead ringer for a person who used to dress up like a nun and molest him when he was a child. So his cathartic way of healing himself is to marry this woman. Marry this woman that is a dead ringer for her. Dress her up as a nun, and then beat the shit out of her and lock her away in the woods.
Yeah, it sounds totally like a movie I would love.
It's got some questionable scenes of interest, but ultimately, it's actually surprisingly fun. Like, the relationship that the lead actress has with her parents is completely unbelievable, mainly because the parents are bad actors. But your meat of the movie is showcased around the abuser and the abusee, and they're both good actors, so it works. Check that out if you like nunsploitation. I found it on YouTube. All I typed in was Blood Bride 1980, and I found it. So there you go, if you're interested. we also checked out the movie Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
This one was discussed. This was, what's Patrick's code name?
This is not actually a code name coming directly from Patrick. This is a legit genre.
Hagsploitation. I mean, what was Patrick's name?
Oh, Patty Cakewolf.
Patty Cakewolf, that's what it is. This was one that Patty Cakewolf suggested we watch.
It's a hagsploitation, as I said, and it's from 1962, which stars Bette Davis and Joan Crawford.
Yeah, and apparently they made this movie because both of their careers were in their death throes. So they thought if they made this movie about crazy old women, that maybe they would get more roles. Joan Crawford plays a really good, insane old lady.
There's a reason for that.
She's kind of
batshit. Right,
everything I read about like the making of this movie made it seem like she was basically playing herself in this movie.
Yeah. We need to watch Mommy Dearest.
In a very real way. So that was kind of disturbing.
She used to beat her own child with coat hangers.
The movie...
I should have aborted you!
Oh, is that where the wire hangers come from?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Anyway, it was a good movie. Like, most old movies are... not very long. This one is over 2 hours
it's
long.
Super
so just
overextending
FYI,
itself.
Yeah. It's so long. And there's a couple scenes, well, no, more than a handful of scenes where you're kind of like, why isn't the sister just yelling for help? Like, she can clearly yell and she never yells out
right.
a window.
So this is basically about a child star called Baby Jane. And she...
Well, just Jane.
Right.
Because she's not a baby now.
Right. Well, when she was a child star, she was known as Baby Jane.
Yes.
And she was loved by everyone, and nobody could take their eyes off of her for reasons. She was like,
I don't know.
Yeah, she was like Shirley Temple, basically.
Yeah, I guess.
She grew up. She didn't have a very prolific career in her adulthood, and her movies were kind of scoffed at. But her sister had a very successful career in film as an adult. And Baby Jane, now as Ugly Jane, the grown-up, is really into sex, drugs, and...
I don't know. There's no sex in this.
Yeah, sex, sex, drugs, and pianos. She doesn't get the sex because she's too ugly, but she gets a lot of the drugs.
Well,
and she gets a little piano.
The drugs being mainly alcohol.
Yeah.
Like a lot of
And you
of
can
alcohol.
Tell that it's wearing on her. Like she's looking grisly.
Yeah, I'm thinking they probably put her on a steady diet of alcohol for this.
Oh yeah, she's definitely like crawling out of the Swedish woods after worshipping a Jotun somewhere.
Right.
Like,
and they she's put her lipstick on
like the world's weighing on her.
Willy nilly, like made her lips twice as big as they should have been.
Yeah.
They really
so
played
she,
up.
She takes it out on her sister, who had the successful career, basically.
Yeah, the one that's paying.
She locks
her
away, and she ties her up. She feeds her dead animals. She's making her life shit. And it's basically a tale of, you know...
it's like not kidnapping, but hostage.
Yeah,
she's
it's a hostage
her,
tale
yeah,
of old women. Yeah,
hostage.
One old woman has another woman held hostage, who's also old. Happens to be her sister.
But, I mean, there's
They're
visitors,
both kind of crazy in their own way.
There's neighbors. at one point, the window's open, and she just can't bring herself to, like, shout hello to her neighbor to get her to come over.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird.
In a way, I feel like this movie should have been done by John Waters. It feels like it is done by him in a way because it's so kind of dirty.
it's so dirty.
But yeah, if you want like a classic film from the 60s, you want to see some crazy Joan Crawford and Bette Davis.
They played the roles well. I mean, Joan Crawford really was.
There's plenty of scenes that don't need to be in there that are just making the movie longer than it should be. But I think when you are done with it, all is said and done, it's an enjoyable ride.
We should clock how long each of them is on the screen, because maybe it was because Joan Crawford was like, no, only if I get equal showing.
You know, I can see that.
Yeah.
Sure. I also checked out Alien River of Pain by Christopher Golden. This one was fun. It's basically a prequel to the Aliens movie. So if you want to know what happens in the gap between Alien and Aliens, you want to see the trial that Ripley undergoes, which is complete bullshit, where they just steamroll her because reasons of the military. and you want to find out what Newt's parents and brother were like. And check it out. I think it's great. I listened to this on Audible. It was a $1.95 pickup for me. They have daily.
Oh, this wasn't a movie.
No, they have daily deals where you can grab like something cool once in a while. And this is a full Audible production, so they've got a team of actors and actresses portraying each character.
Like a play.
They got sound effects pulled right from the Aliens movies.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like you're right there. I love it. I love the iconic Alien sounds and the sounds of gunfire from the Marines' guns. It's a great fucking listen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say read, but I just heard it.
Well, you could read it if you wanted
to. You could.
To.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably more fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess we'll talk a little bit about the Steve Alton Meg book. Let me ask you something, Miss Cake Bitch.
Okay.
Do you think it would be scary to be submersed within a tiny submersible craft 7 miles down?
Yeah.
Completely surrounded by darkness?
Mm-hmm.
And...
I would not do well.
No, mm-hmm. No. And sometimes these submersible pilots go all by their lonesome. You're going to be surrounded not only by darkness, but at times when you turn on the lights, you're going to see up to over 10 million species, possibly. Some of them looking like spaghetti monsters.
Yeah. Oh, I love deep sea creatures.
Yeah.
They are super cool looking. Usually hideous.
Mm-hmm. There's some that look just like spaghetti.
Yeah.
Glowing spaghetti.
Nice.
Yeah. So up until 1977, every scientist and, you know, wishy-washy hugabaloo or whatever the hell they're called, naysayers, that's the word I'm thinking of.
Armchair scientists.
Right. They basically said, no, there's nothing down there.
It's too hot.
Yeah, there's just nothing.
No way.
Nope. Not going to happen. Too much pressure. There's just no food source. There's no photosynthesis.
Life is too fragile to live there.
Yeah, it can't happen. Much like people say, outer space, things living out there other than us, you're crazy.
Yeah.
Well,
except it's always aliens.
Right. I mean, I think it's not. It's not much more than a stone throw away from us before we get, like, butt raped by aliens.
Why does everyone think these aliens are into anal probes? Like, can't they just be interested in, like, observing, like in Star Trek, when humans go into space? And we can't interact.
We watched that one TV series. It was an anthology by R.L. Stine, The Haunting Hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an alien episode, but they weren't into asses because it's a kid's show. They were into toes. They ate toes.
I don't think I watched that one, did I?
Maybe. So 1977, the Alvin submersible had discovered life in the depths. They had discovered that there's a thing called chemosynthesis going on down there. So even cooler than photosynthesis, they got something pretty badass. There are these tube worms that I was talking about. They're like spaghetti monsters of the deep. And they basically lived off bacteria off of their body, which fed off of hydrothermal vents. So that's like the beginning of the sort of like food system going on down there.
Yeah,
It's
probably the origins of life itself.
And you were
go on.
Right, and you were saying that it's too hot down there.
Yeah.
Yes, it is extremely hot. That's because the hydrothermal vents. Lots of.
Yeah, this is as close to the molten core as you can get.
Yes.
On Earth.
And luckily, this is on American land.
Luckily.
Sort of. So. That's where our story initializes. The Mariana Trench is the lowest place on Earth. It's near Hawaii.
Land of the volcanoes.
Right. I think it's closest to Guam is what they were saying, which is a part of Hawaii.
It's not part of Hawaii. But
oh, it's not?
No, it's out in the Pacific Ocean. It's another U.S. territory. Pacific.
So it's 7 miles deep, this Mariana Trench. And it's 40 miles wide, 1,550 feet long. And basically what's going on here is our boy Jonas Taylor. He's a naval submersible pilot. He goes down into the Mariana Trench. The part of it that he goes into is the Challenger Deep, which has the stats that I was reading out. That's the lowest point. And he goes down there because reasons of the government. They have like a fake thing that they tell him that they need him to go down there for.
Yeah,
it's to like deal with seismic readings
so that
they can try to help, you know more about earthquakes and warning people and so on
legit.
And so forth.
Yeah,
but that's not why he's actually going down there. There's another reason.
Is it because they know about the Megalodon?
Well, I'm not gonna say, but you do find out that there's a lot of like the government's kind of shady business throughout the Steve Alton books.
Nothing new.
It gets fun. It gets fun. Yeah. Military espionage and all that jazz. Anyway, our pilot Jonas is going down, even though this is like his third descent in a week, which is crazy because you need a lot of rest because it weighs heavy on your mind to go and be separated from everyone for that long on this descent to where you are just a few inches away from certain death because your submersible gets damaged, you're pretty much shit out of luck. Like, you're going to run out of oxygen. If it gets cracked, you're just going to fucking explode.
Well, implode, I guess.
Yes, you would implode because there's, like, so many square inches of pressure on every side of you. Yeah. Like, just bearing down.
Scientists are nuts.
Yeah. So he goes down there with two other people. He knows that he shouldn't be doing it, but the government says, look, if you don't do it, we're going to get your buddy to do it. And he's, you know, a headstrong kid. And so Jonas goes down because he doesn't want his younger friend to get himself killed.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes down. He sees something down there that is trying to eat the submersible. He thinks it's a giant shark. But maybe he's crazy because he's got sleep deprivation and all of these other crazy things that happen when you, you know, you're going down and not getting enough rest. When he disengages his weights and starts accelerating the submersible to go back up,
right,
to escape the jaws of death, he gives one of his co-pilots a concussion and the other one has... oxygen deprivation and dies a little bit later. They both die basically, but Jonas is able to
too fast?
Right.
Okay.
Jonas is able to live because he finds like a little oxygen container thingy that he takes. There was like damage to the submersible, so they lost oxygen and issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they escape, they steamroll, much like they steamrolled Ripley. They steamroll Jonas and say, oh, you're nuts. There's nothing down there. And you saw things and you panicked and you had training for this and you blew it. So now we're going to say you're crazy. You're seeing sharks everywhere. We're going to send you to an institution and then we're going to discharge you from the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. They send him to an institution and discharge him.
Okay.
So without getting into too much of the meat of things, when he's discharged, he takes on a life of studying megalodons because
he did not have enough of it.
Right. Because he wants to know that these things are real and he wasn't crazy and he's not responsible for these boys' deaths. It was just him trying to escape and save them. And unfortunately,
it didn't work out.
Right. Well, the long and skinny of, or the short skinny of it is that he has an opportunity to go back down into the Mariana Trench and he has reason to believe that there is something down there. So he does go down and he has a second submersible with him that ends up getting engaged with a megalodon male.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid panics. He does not make it. The megalodon bites down on his submersible and gets wrapped up in the submersible and gets kind of like stuck.
Mm-hmm.
It's like damaged and kind of ascending. And a giant 60-foot megalodon female that's pregnant goes up to the male, says, look, free lunch. Tears open its stomach, and then it's like very cold on the ascent, which is why the megalodons had stayed below. They're used to the temperature. They're used to their food source down there. They have no idea what's up above, so they're not going to go adventure.
Snacks.
So, you know, it wouldn't be able to survive the cold, but the hot blood of these megalodons, they're extremely hot-blooded, is pouring out. And creating a sort of blanket for the female Meg to travel to the surface. So that's how she gets up there. And now Jonas can say, oh, you know what? I was not responsible for the deaths of those two dudes. But I'm about to be responsible for the deaths of tons of other people because a lot of people die in this story. And the deaths are really creative at times. Very creepy, too. There's one where a chick gets bit in half, and while she's dying in the stomach of the giant Meg, she's talking through her intercom system to her lover, saying, please come save me. The lover's looking at this giant fucking shark opening its mouth, like, you know, come on in to go save her. And just like the sounds of her screaming for help coming through the intercom.
Really disturbing.
Is fucked up. There's a lot of action that we're going to potentially see in the movie, which is going to come out hopefully this year for Meg, starring Jason Statham. And the book lends itself well to a movie adaptation, I think. There's a lot of kills that the shark takes on. There's even some people that survive at the skin of their teeth with like chance encounters with the Meg. So we've got like a lot of little side bits to chew on throughout it. And the main story, of course, is Jonas working with some people to capture the Meg or destroy it. But basically get it out of the equation before the babies come and start destroying the ecosystem. But mainly they want to capture it.
Okay.
They want to capture it because sequels, right?
Science. Sequels.
And that's what I'm thinking. But turned itself around on me. And the ending of this is so fucking violent. Incredibly violent. And you really get to see how badass Jonas is. And how badass Jason Statham will be if this movie takes it the way that the end of this book did. Because, oh my god, violence. Complete violence. Okay. I would love to say what, like, just the massive carnage.
Well, then you're gonna ruin everything, though.
But you gotta check it out. It's a fantastic read. I'm already on the next sequel. I believe there's 5 or 6 sequels.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's a lot of source material to go off of. And I will tell you that they're not gonna go crazy, like, voodoo sharks like they did with the Jaws books.
Voodoo sharks?
Yeah, I seem to remember, now I might be crazy, but I seem to remember one of the Jaws books having like a fucking a voodoo theme where someone has a voodoo doll of the shark and is making, like,
oh,
controlling
Lord.
It.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway. but no, this is like done by somebody who really loved the original Jaws and wanted to make really scary shark stories.
Yeah.
And they're succeeding. The sequel is it's fantastic as well.
So are they still writing
so far
books?
But yeah, I don't know. I haven't really okay. spent the time to look into the author Steve
okay.
Alton.
That's fair.
But yeah, I am very excited for it.
Okay.
And I think the movie needs to open up with a scene of a T-Rex going out into the deeps to catch some prey that are trying to escape him, and then meeting up with the Megalodon, and then getting completely fucked up by the Megalodon.
See,
like, the beginning of the book, what I'm getting at, showcases a scene from the prehistoric era,
right.
And it just is like, hey, want to know how badass this giant shark is? It fucking eats a T-Rex like nobody's business. And I would love it if the movie does the same thing and is just like, fuck you, Jurassic Park. There's a new beast on the scene.
I would love that. I don't think T-Rexes can swim out to the middle of the ocean.
Because they've got those really tiny arms.
Tiny arms, and like their legs don't seem like they're fit.
No, they're tall, so they describe it kind of like him going out there a little bit too deep, but, you know, like his neck's still kind of sticking out.
I don't know that they were that tall, though.
Let me go ahead, take some time, and I'll find out the measurements of the body of water that they were describing in the story.
Okay.
I'll get some measurements of the height of a T-Rex.
Right.
And the width of a Megalodon.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll figure it all out.
Okay. We'll do some
We'll
math
do that
later.
Right now.
We don't need to do it
on
right now.
The show. All right. Anyway, let's go ahead and hit up our song, unless you wanted to mention anything else.
No, it's fine. You can play Fish Head.
Okay.
Fish Head? Fish Heads.
It's Fish Heads. It's
fish heads, plural. Many mm-hmm. Fish Heads.
Yes. Fish Heads by Barnes & Barnes coming at you, and then we're going to be hitting up our fillin'.
Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, eat them up, yum. Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads. Fish heads, eat them up, yum.
happy fish heads in the evening, floating in the soup.
Fish heads, fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, fish heads, fish heads, eat them up, yum.
Ask a fish head anything you want to, they won't answer, they can't talk. They don't play drums.
Fish heads, fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, fish heads, fish heads, eat them up, yum.
Roly-poly fish heads are never seen drinking cappuccino in Italian restaurants with Oriental women.
Would you eat a fish head, Miss Cake Bitch? No.
Absolutely not.
No?
I'm horrified. Like, okay, so that one Thai restaurant that we go to, or like very occasionally, Bangkok Wok, they serve fish, and I think they serve it with the head on, and I can't.
Would you take a fish head to the movies?
If it was your fish head.
You wouldn't have to pay to get it in.
Just a disembodied fish head.
Yeah.
This is my date. Can I just bring him in? Yeah. No, fish heads, like, really gross me out. Their eyes are, like, jello. Ugh.
They're vapid. They're dead. Dead eyes.
Well, that's because they're dead fish, too.
Soulless.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much going on behind that fish brain.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like fish are probably pretty stupid.
I feel like that saying, when you stare into the void stares back into you, is talking about someone staring at a fish head. Yeah. It's to the eyes, those black fucking creepy eyes.
I'm going to start putting fish eyes on all the photos of Donald Trump now. It's going to be amazing!
So, I guess we're talking about the legend of the Hanover here. And how he made such an impact on our culture that we graced him by making him a Monster in My Pocket figurine. This is a figurine, action figure series from Matchbox that was around when I was a child. So the Jenny Hanover is the monster, but they just call it the Hanover. Because it sounds scarier that way, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jenny Hanover sounds like the girl you asked to go to the prom with you.
Right. And Hanover kind of sounds like
Hannibal.
Something that... Okay, yeah, Hannibal, I can see that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking Hanover Toyota. I always hear commercials on the radio. Hanover Toyota, lease your car today.
Oh, you mean like Hanover, the place in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Hanover, PA.
Yeah, okay.
You go there and there are all these fish monsters that attack you and try to sell you cars.
It's all these, like, what, monkfish.
So this Monster in My Pocket, if you listened to our last variety show and we mentioned that these Monster in My Pockets have point values, which basically act as their strength level, how powerful they are. So when you're a kid, you can look at the back of the thing and there's a little shoddily etched number into there. And you can be like, my T-Rex can kick Jesus's ass because Jesus doesn't have a fucking number on him. But my T-Rex has a 25.
They should have made Jesus one of the monsters. If they're going to put some Hindu gods in there, they should have put Jesus in there.
Monster in my pocket, Jesus style.
Jesus!
This Hanover has a power ranking, a point value, if you will, of 15. This is the 22nd monster in my pocket that appeared in Series 1. It's basically looking... Well, this is the figurine itself I'm going to describe. It looks like a giant fish head with wings on either side of its head. Maybe even, fins. They look more like butterfly wings, though.
Like maybe gills that have been butterflied off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A giant mouth that looks very angry. It looks like he's doing some screamo. Huh? And then he's got tiny little stubby legs.
Yeah, it's real weird looking. It's not real scary.
It looks like he might even be wearing...
a vagina monster.
He kind of does, yeah.
Yeah,
I think that says it pretty well. I think he looks like a weird vagina monster.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't scare me, probably because I have a vagina monster, so...
Yeah.
That's it for Jenny Hanover. We can move on to the rest of our show.
So the Jenny Hanover inspired a couple other monsters. It's a very early creature in history. This one appeared in possibly as early as 1558, so this was 16th century. It inspired some things like the bishop fish as well as monkfish that I believe Christina, Miss Cake Bitch, had mentioned earlier. What it essentially is just a skate or a manta ray, stingray,
right?
That was dried and then carved to look really fucking creepy.
Yeah. And I mean, they're pretty fun looking.
Right.
I wouldn't mind having one if we ever came across Jenny Hanover.
Oh, for sure. I think if we ever lived by an area where we could access dead stingray that are just like washed up on the shore or something.
Oh, you'd try to make one yourself?
I would turn it into a craft.
Ooh, that would be real smelly.
When I was a kid, I remember all these horseshoe crabs that would wash up on the shore of Long Beach in
New York.
In New York, Long Island. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I would walk the beach and just like pick up the horseshoe crabs and put them back in the water. And then they would just come right back out.
Were they dead by the time you found them?
I think some of them were, and that's why they just came back to me.
Yeah.
And I thought they thought it was a game. But I was trying to save them.
They always really creeped me out when I was a kid. I hadn't seen that many, but like when we were at the shore, sometimes we'd find the horseshoe crabs. Yeah. And like they are kind of like they look prehistoric.
They look like monsters. They look like trilobites.
Like they're pretty cool looking, but they terrified me when I was a kid.
Or if you're a fan of Pokemon, they look like Kabuto. So my dad at the time, he was walking with me, and he said, "I'm going to tell you a story." And the short and skinny of it is, person is walking down the beach. They see a horseshoe crab. Are like fucking graveyard, just tons of them everywhere. Dude picks one up, puts it in, keeps walking, and then picks another one up and puts it in. The other person says to him, "Why are you only picking up, you know, one here and there? Why do you even bother? It's just one here and one there." And the guy says, "Well, I bother because it matters to that one individual that I'm saving."
Oh.
So I was like, I'm going to save all of them.
See, the story that I had growing up was starfish.
Uh-huh.
People throwing starfish back in the ocean.
Okay.
Yeah.
It probably did originate from something like that.
I've never seen
it. And my dad just applied it to what was there at the moment. He's like,
terrifyingly ugly.
Come on, help me save these things. Come on, kid.
Help me put these back in the ocean. Well, that's a nice story.
This one came back.
Though,
it liked me.
It's
fucking dead, you stupid kid.
Just throw it further.
Help it. Throw it further, you'll help it along. So the Hanover, let's have you talk a little bit about this bad boy.
Okay. So as you said, the earliest known picture of a Jenny Hanover was in Conrad Gessner's Historia Animalum, volume 4.
Seems legit, yeah.
That was 1558. And he actually was warning people that you should not believe that these disfigured rays were anything evil or different from disfigured rays.
But some people were like, oh, no, actually, those are basilisks.
Yes.
Because basilisks were all the rage back then.
You couldn't go anywhere
without hearing about a basilisk.
Was that they were basilisks. And, you know, nobody...
We
got
to go visit Grandma this weekend, kiddies.
What a basilisk.
You don't
want to
see Grandma.
Like.
Grandma's a basilisk. In-laws coming over? Nope, can't have them over. They're basilisks.
Yes, apparently people were gotta pay very our bills. Scared.
Can't pay those bills. They're basilisks. Yeah, so basilisks. Yeah. Basically, they were...
They were created to look like no one in particular thing. They were created to look like devils or angels or dragons. They're pretty creepy.
Well, I think it's creepy to say, I mean, basilisks, if you looked at them, they were kind of like gorgons, but they wouldn't turn you to stone. They would just fucking outright kill you.
They would kill you, yeah.
So, you know, people thinking that these Hanovers were basilisks in a way is kind of disturbing because they look creepy. And, you know, thinking in your head, if I look at this thing, I'm going to drop dead.
Well, does the basilisk have to be alive to kill you? Because these are very clearly not alive.
I don't know. We're going to have to go and find a basilisk somewhere. I'll go down to Basilisks R Us. I can't say basilisks.
I mean, it's a weird
it's
word.
It's a hard word basilisk. To say. You think the local PetSmart would have it?
We should go and ask them, do you have any basilisks for sale? Their name, the Jenny Hanovers, is actually a cockneyed version of a French phrase.
Mm.
It was, I'm going to say, Jenny de Anvers.
Nailed
really,
it.
Yeah, totally. I took French back when I was in fifth grade and I was a Mardi Gras queen. You're welcome. what was I going to say?
You'd speak French better than I can. When I try to speak French, it's just like, oh-ho, and frolics.
Oui, oui.
Yeah.
So anyways, these things were actually sold by sailors in the mid-16th century as a way to earn a little extra money, I guess, so that they could either feed themselves or get really wasted while they were on shore.
Yeah.
So they actually began selling them just as novelties to tourists. So there's really no, like, creepy, monstrous beginnings to these things.
Yeah.
These are just, like, somebody's side hustle while they're on land.
They were like the...
Grab these rays, dry them out, carve them up, sell them to stupid tourists for probably way too much money.
Yeah.
And then go get a burger and fries.
Yeah. They were like
beer.
The OG rubber chicken.
Yeah.
Here, kid, I got you a fucking Hanover thing.
They do kind of look
take
like
it and
rubber chickens.
Take it
in
and
a
annoy
way.
Your sister.
Yeah, they're just cartilage carved up to look kind of ugly.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fun little entry on what is it called, Journal of the Bazaar, about these guys, and they actually have a picture of Salvador Dali holding one.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is really fun.
Yeah.
They
look like something that would crawl out of his mind.
Yeah, they do actually. Yeah. So they think these might be a little bit connected to the tale of the sea monk that seafarers would tell about a mythical monster. And they called him the sea monk because he supposedly looked like a monk.
But of the sea.
A monk of the sea.
Yeah.
Is it chicken or is it tuna? It says chicken of the sea. But most people who are
so
looking
like,
back on this now think that those were just giant squids because all the depictions look like he has a bunch of tentacles. Because
squids look like fat, balding dudes, right?
Well, they do kind of. Squids are really smart, though. Squids and octopus, they're really smart. And a fun fact about Jenny Hanover's is that, they're still sold as tourist items in some parts of the world, but they're actually damaging the conservation efforts of rays because stingrays and their cousins actually their age of reproduction, like their when they can actually reproduce, actually happens very late in their life.
Uh-huh.
And their reproduction rates are actually very low. So combine those two things, and then people hunting them to make these Jenny Hanovers, their population is not great. There's a lot of them that are on the endangered list or flagged, a red flag for conservation efforts. So that's kind of sad. I guess I wouldn't want a new Jenny Hanover.
Yeah, probably
with
not.
That in mind.
I don't think I could do that. Yeah.
I think if we found one in an antique shop that was like from the 1700s or something, I'd probably snap it up. It would probably cost an arm and a leg too.
Or if you're Christian,
it's falling apart.
Then you can do it. You can buy all of them, and then you can just give the church like $10 and be like, "Sorry, Jesus," and you're good.
No. I have a conscience. I can't do it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I wouldn't be able to do it. It's kind of like people who eat turtle soup because there's still some cultures that make it. I don't know that I'd be able to eat turtle soup knowing that it's made from, like, a little baby turtle that probably was on its last leg of survival. Yeah. I just couldn't.
So no. Turtles are cute.
I don't think I could do it for a Jenny Hanover either. Mm. I mean, the ray is already dead, but that's one less they'd have to kill if I don't buy one.
Yeah. We do have a giant turtle shell hanging on our wall, but it's fake.
Yeah, it's a reproduction. Yeah.
Someone actually just found a giant turtle, put some plaster on his shell, and then...
They made a cast of it? Yeah. Is that what happened? Mm. Okay. It's pretty cool looking. I if it were a real turtle shell, I don't know that I would have felt good about that.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, so let's check out the trading card text on the Hanover and see if Monster in My Pockets have their shit together.
Okay.
So, species, reptilian serpent. No.
No.
Born.
Well, unless it's a basilisk.
Basilisk. Boogaloogle. Basilisks.
Those are like.
Yeah, possibly.
Serpent birds.
Born 16th century in Belgium.
Yeah, we'll give them that.
Size, 4 feet across.
I mean...
They're all 4 feet across.
Oh, every single...
Exactly.
None of them look very wide, so they would have to be enormously tall.
They're like every male's penis.
They just...
really big.
Magically grow.
Really big.
It's a fish story.
Huge. Habitat. In shallow waters and beach areas.
I guess that would be true.
Mm-hmm. And then it has its little flavor text here. An extremely vicious monster. The Hanover lives both on land and in the sea. This unusual looking creature has a huge head, virtually no body, and two short stubby legs. He can be found just offshore, where underwater he may resemble an innocent ray. That is until he opens his mouth and exposes multiple rows of sharp poisonous teeth! Exclamation point. The Hanover is known to surprise his victims by burying himself in sand and waiting for an unsuspecting beachgoer to pass. He's especially fond of tourists. Be sure to think twice next time before you pick up that seashell sticking out of the sand. It may be the top of a Hanover. Waiting for dinner. So that's what that's supposed to be. I thought it was like a bowler cap on his head, but it's meant to look like a shell. So it's kind of like, oh, look, daddy,
a
seashell.
Yeah. It's a clitoris.
It's a clitoris shell.
Yeah.
Like, a little kid comes by, he's a tourist child, a seashell, picks it up, fucking giant monster face comes out, and bites off his head.
If you pull something out of the sand like that, I feel like it would have to scream like little mandrake root.
Yeah.
It would be like, ah, no, put me back!
I like the Jenny Hanover. As a kid, I didn't know what the hell it was. I thought it was a giant flying head. But now I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real Jenny Hanovers are actually more, much more terrifying looking.
Yeah.
Than, the monster in my pockets. So
another homemade sea monster that they didn't make into a monster in my pocket, but I think it's worth mentioning while we're on the Jenny Hanover.
Yeah.
Is the Fiji mermaid. Not as old as the Jenny Hanover, But what we do have here is a creature that kind of resembles a mix between a monkey top half and a fish bottom half.
Right.
And then it looks like some fish-like hands almost, like webbed hands. And it kind of seems like they did like a weird carving job on its face. So, yeah, it's like part monkey, part fish, and it was sold to be like, oh, look, mermaids are real. And P.T. Barnum got a hold of this through means. It basically was purchased by an American sea captain who purchased it from some Japanese people that probably laughed because dude had to, like, pull money from places he wasn't supposed to.
Right.
Like the ship's reserves.
Yeah. He pulled it from the ship.
$6,000 for this part monkey, part fish. And this
is. In the 1800s.
Yeah. This is an 1822.
That's a mega bucks.
You talk about inflation.
That's why he had to rent it out to P.T. Barnum.
Yeah. He rented it out for $12.50 a week. Well, the guy who found it didn't, but his son did, because he just kind of passed it down through the family.
He was still paying off the debt.
Yeah, let's keep paying this shit off. $12.50 a week. So before VHS tapes, we had the Fiji Mermaid.
Yeah. Well, and a bunch of freak shows and P.T. Barnum.
You couldn't put it in and like watch images play on a screen, but you could set it in front of the family and all sit down in front of it and beat off together.
Oh.
$12.50 a week. You got to get something out of it.
That was also a good amount of money.
Yeah. So P.T. Barnum, he ran a circus, Barnum and Bailey's, and he had some fires that he dealt with that destroyed some of his collection. And it said that the Fiji mermaid creature was lost in one of those fires. This was not before he tried to get it verified. So he had some scientists check it out. And what's interesting is the scientists said, well, we don't believe in mermaids, but we can't say that this thing isn't real because it doesn't look fabricated.
What you mean is we can't say this isn't real because P.T. Barnum paid us to say we can't say that this isn't real.
Maybe, but I think that's interesting because it leaves a little bit up to the imagination. And I think that's why we get a little bit more nods to the Fiji mermaid in today's culture, rather than the Jenny Hanover.
Because some writer in the 1500s didn't debunk it immediately.
Yeah.
Somebody paid the scientist to be like, well, we'll never know.
Some things are as simple as that, to just create a mystery and a lore around something obscure.
Yeah.
Rob Zombie's House of 1,000 Corpses, we've got one of the characters in there get murdered and then get turned into a strange, like, amalgamation of man and fish. And this taxidermy job's meant to resemble the Fiji mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an episode of The X-Files that covers deaths that are happening at a sideshow. And it's led to believe that
the Fiji mermaid is
behind.
It's hopping around on its fin.
So that's interesting. I would like to watch it again. It's been so long. Anyway, Fiji mermaid, Jenny Hanover. We've got a couple of monsters that we threw at you. Yeah, that's our little Monster in My Pocket talk. Now let's go ahead and move into our Does Romance Belong in Horror section, going a little bit further into the filling. So, does romance belong in horror, Miss Cake Bitch? What do you think?
I think it's really hard to incorporate actual romance in with horror.
Yeah, I mean, why exactly are we talking about romance in horror? I think it's
because
not...
it's February.
Yeah, it's February, so we're a little bit late to the Valentine's game, but we're here. A belated I love you is better than no I love yous.
Right. And hopefully we get this posted before it's March.
Yeah. Today, as I said before, fish And romance is today's theme.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, every time you say it, I remember a friend of mine's mother. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that her mother actually said it, because it could have just been her saying that she says it.
Oh, okay.
But my friend used to say that her mom had this phrase where she would say, if it smells like fish, make it a dish. In reference to a lady parts.
Yeah.
So if it smells like fish, I guess you're supposed to serve it up and have somebody eat at that.
Yeah. I guess that was what, from the aunt? Or the grandmother?
No, my friend's mom.
Mom? Did the dad say, if it smells like kielbasa, looks like kielbasa, then you gotta choke on it?
If it looks like kielbasa or smells like kielbasa?
I think looks like kielbasa.
I feel like smells might be more apt analogy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just kind of balancing things out, you know?
if it smells like kielbasa, I'm not going to want to choke on that.
You got to eat the fishy vagina. You're going to have to choke on the...
kielbasa penis.
Yeah.
Ugh. So gross.
Get down on it.
So that's romantic.
Yeah. So let's say, for me, does romance belong in horror? I think for the most part, no. But I think there's some surprising things that can turn people's look on that around.
Yeah.
My first question to you would be, why the popular association of vampires and love? We've got Interview with the Vampire, Bram Stoker, Dracula, Underworld, True Blood, Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Only Lovers Left Alive. And, of course, we cannot mention this without mentioning Twilight.
You just lost all your horror cred. Well, I think that vampires and romance go together just because there's a simple act of vulnerability in the way that vampires typically feed, which is from your neck.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of mirrors heavy making out.
Okay.
So we've all gotten hickeys, like, you know, somebody sucks on your neck too hard.
So you're thinking like Ghoulies made people afraid to go and take a shit.
Yeah,
they're afraid to go use the toilet. So once the Ghoulies were released, kids all around the world, they're just finding new places to take their dumps. They're opening up the toaster. They're peeling back the carpet and just shitting under there.
My sister. Well, I should
they're
say,
shitting in their dad's slippers and blaming the dog.
My sister and my cousin both, well, not while they were like actually potty trained, but before they were potty trained, would go in the closet to take a shit.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. They must have saw Ghoulies.
And I think my little cousin, well, he's not little anymore, but I think he used to go in the closet too to take his shit.
Oh, Christ. Yeah, so you're saying it's kind of like that. So it's meant to make people afraid to make out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, I don't
so
know.
So vampires
about,
were
I don't
created.
Think afraid to make out.
Vampires
think,
were created by some youth group. Right? Some like after school special Christian youth group.
No.
Let's make them scary so the kids don't want to kiss each other.
Vampires.
Jesus power!
Vampires were created because people were being declared dead before they were dead.
It might be. I mean, you know, the cross repels them, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not all the time. Only no. Some of the time.
Yeah,
I think a lot of vampires are not repelled by the cross.
This is
they kind of go,
this is a
huh,
youth
all
group,
right.
This is a youth group powwow
yeah.
That created the vampire here.
No, I think it's just this, I think it's just this vulnerability that we show every time we're with someone. Just yeah. Exposing your neck in general is a very vulnerable place to be. Anyone could punch you there and, like, knock shut your windpipe. Like, it's a very vulnerable area of your body.
Well, I'll tell you that most of these movies I've listed are good. And the ones that are good, even the love in them, it does take away from the horror.
Yeah.
It does lose horror cred when you've got the love thing going on there. I think the one that rides it closest to still being scary while having a romance theme is Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, and I think maybe the love story also humanizes them in a way, rather than making them into pure monsters. I think it's kind of, they still have a shred of humanity left in them.
Yeah, but I think humanizing a monster generally is a bad thing. If you want it to be scary, I should say.
Right. I guess so. Yeah. Like, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night isn't a scary movie.
Yeah.
Because it has a complex vampiric character.
Right.
Who isn't pure evil.
That's why I find movies like Salem's Lot, 30 Days of Night very refreshing. These monsters don't give a fuck.
They're just monsters.
Yeah. They are completely devoid of humanity, and they just want to eat you up. They want lick-em-ups.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that makes the vampire scary, but not this love thing. I mean, yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I think that might just be a very old tradition. Going back further, because the ones that make them into pure monsters are more recent, typically. Like, and it could be that back in the day, preying on a young woman was the worst possible thing somebody could ever think would happen.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just evolving.
Plus, I can't imagine any woman that would fall for the master in Salem's Lot. Like,
Does not
seem like it's happening.
I don't think I've seen Salem's Lot.
Dude is creepy. He looks like me, but with bigger teeth, yellow eyes,
ooh,
blue skin.
Well, aren't they supposed to have some sort of, like, power that they can entrance you? Is that a common thing in
the rules are all lore? Dependent on the story, because it's always changing. But yeah, I mean, that's really my final thought with it. I honestly think that it just is, it's taking away from the horror, and the movies, you know, they're fine, but I don't think it has a place in horror.
You don't find them as blood curdlingly terrifying.
No, I don't find vampire movies scary at all when they've got the romance segments in there.
Do you find them enjoyable?
Does not
though?
Work for horror.
I mean,
they can be enjoyable.
So it doesn't.
They can
kill
still
the movie
be a good movie,
right?
But it doesn't necessarily have a place in a horror movie.
That's cute.
Yeah, that's the master.
Okay.
You like him?
He's,
look at that.
He's blue.
Yeah.
Why is he so blue?
I don't know. He's like me, right?
In the morning.
Next question. We've got the metamorphosis of relationships, and we're going to look at The Fly as an example. 1986, David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
So you saw this with me. Mm-hmm. In this film, we've basically got Jeff Goldblum, kind of quirky, lovable scientist, falls in love with a reporter.
Yeah.
And then he gets his DNA merged with a fly because
he accidentally
splices stuck.
Himself.
Yep. He gets stuck in a transportation system that he's working on. And, as the relationship progresses and his metamorphosis progresses, he is becoming very strange. He's mm-hmm. changing in a lot of different ways, as people do in relationships, as you get used to someone. So I think there's a good parallel with the horror here that works with a romance theme of relationships, because it's got a common ground that people can relate to. When you're with someone, you kind of experience them unfolding mm-hmm. and showing more of their true self.
Right.
So that can easily be applied to The Fly, I think.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
people are always on their best behaviors at the beginning.
When you're first dating, you don't get to see all the ugly underbelly.
Right.
You're always, like, pleasant in the morning. You brush mm-hmm. your teeth before they wake up so that you don't have morning breath.
Yeah. And then you start calling them cake bitch.
Yeah.
And being a complete bastard.
Yeah, just being an asshole every morning. rolling out of bed 10 minutes before you need to leave, and then bitching at me because you're going to be late, that sort of thing.
Yeah, relatable things that don't necessarily have to do with us, but yeah, you see what I mean.
Well, you also witnessed me begging you to throw me out a window during my 3-month-long insomnia stretch, too. Things get ugly.
But that's like a thing that can be dealt with. Some people can't, right. And that's scary because you can be with someone that's very nice and fluffy at the beginning, and then as they're unfolding and getting more used to you, they turn into a giant blood-sucking fly.
Right. Or like a literal abusive monster.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that example, I think horror does merge with romance very well.
Yeah, it's that dark side of romance gone bad. Yeah.
How about Forbidden Love? Looking at Crimson Peak from 2015 and Hellraiser from 1987. Crimson Peak, we've got some incest. And in Hellraiser, we've got some adultery between Julia and Frank.
Right. Mm-hmm. Incest is the best.
The bestest.
Yeah.
Incestus is the bestest.
Bestest. Bestest for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Okay, so what exactly
it's definitely trending on Pornhub, I'll tell you that.
Oh god.
Like I cannot go on Pornhub and just try to find like some like cosplay of like Final Fantasy VII.
So not Festivus. You're or talking like about
DC comic book characters. Like I'm just looking for stupid, you know, nerdy shit. And then every like other suggestion is incest fantasy. It's like
it's huge on like fan erotica sites too.
It's fucking weird. Like,
why is everyone obsessed with having sex with their relation?
There was an episode of Supernatural I watched that was written by the fans, and they had made a lot of jokes about fan fiction that was written about them.
Mm-hmm.
And they make a comment that's apparently real, that there's a ton of incestuous homoerotica between Sam and Dean, brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's huge, apparently. The person I was dating at the time was really into it, apparently, so that was in a thing. That was a thing.
Is this like the transformation into the fly?
So yeah, anyway, I think the horror in Hellraiser between Julia and Frank is interesting. Julia is cheating on her husband with her husband's brother, Frank, who has basically led a life of seeking out pleasure in all of its greatest forms. Right. Like chasing the dragon kind of thing.
He's not getting any real fulfillment from Julia.
Yeah.
And Julia is probably, she's like torn up with guilt.
Yeah.
But she can't stop herself.
Yeah, and they're both kind of feeding each other throughout it. So I think the parallel runs pretty strong in here with her bringing him victims so that he can like sate himself through causing this pain because she wants to make him happy so that he can fuck her, which is this whole like backward situation.
Yeah.
Crimson Peak, you have things to say about Crimson Peak, I'm sure.
I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that twist where you find out they're brother and sister and in love.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. But I don't know. See, when I watched Crimson Peak, I did not really get that it was a love story between the brother and sister until they introduced that twist. Yeah. There is also a love story between the girl in the castle and the brother.
I don't really find Crimson Peak very scary, to be honest.
See, I was terrified the whole time, but that's because of jump scares.
Okay.
Those really, like, get to me because I don't know when something's gonna jump out. So it wasn't so much the love story or even the fact that they were ghosts. It was more just me, like, being afraid that something was going to jump out at me at any given moment.
Well, I like the story of Crimson Peak. I think the love
triangle
aspect of it just, again, it took away from the horror.
I mean, I don't know that that was really a scary story to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, twisted, yes, but scary. I don't know. Like, I was really just...
It had its moments.
I was just scared because of the jump scares that whole time.
Honestly,
I like jump scares.
Honestly, I don't feel like they portrayed incest as a scary thing there.
Oh, no.
They didn't make forbidden love seem terrifying.
No. It was just, like, their fate was that they fell in love with each other.
Hellraiser they did, though, I think.
What?
They made forbidden love seem scary.
Well, that's because there's so many parallels where the woman does do awful things for her man.
So it can work.
So, yeah, it can work. That kind of aspect is grounded in reality.
I can see forbidden love being horror and romance merging well. How about reincarnation, destined to meet one another, sort of like 1932's The Mummy. Also Blackula.
Yeah.
That's another example.
Mm-hmm.
Finding someone that you loved long ago. You're an ancient being.
You're the undead.
You're cursed to not have them, but you can't help but want them.
Right. So you find them everywhere you go.
Yeah. I don't really find aspects of Blackula or The Mummies very scary. They're good movies, and I love them.
But yeah, I don't think that they were all that scary either.
The aspects of romance or love in them does not make it it doesn't help the horror.
That the only thing that's really tied to the horror is that there's usually not a good outcome for the person who is the love interest.
Right.
They usually die in some horrible way. But like the reincarnation and the soulmate thing isn't really a horror thing.
Yeah.
It kind of softens up the storyline a little bit. I mean, it might add a little interest.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't make it scarier.
So I think we've got some good examples of romance that does work with horror and romance that does not help the horror. My last one here is Love Hurts, looking cathartically at a movie called Audition from 1999, which basically is about a dude that's in the film industry that's looking for a life partner. And so he holds a fake movie that's going to be coming out. He's running an audition for the lead actress, and he's asking questions to these people to find someone that he wants to be with for the rest of his life. He gets involved with a woman that goes to the audition. She becomes obsessed with him. He pulls back. Situation gets weird. She's highly obsessive and crazy, and things get tortury and very bizarre. You want to see something creepy? You want to watch Audition. So I think, that's something we can relate to. We've all pined over someone, and it was unrequited love. Mm-hmm. It was not reciprocated, and we were left feeling like, shit, now my dick is in my hand again.
I didn't feel
or
like
your
that.
Vulva is in your hand again. I
usually just felt crushed and heartbroken.
Okay.
So...
usually
there were no genitalias in my hand.
Usually as soon as my chances were broken and I wasn't going to get my affections returned, at the very instant that it would happen, my hand would just descend right into my pants.
It didn't work that way for me. Incidentally,
no, I think that's relatable. I think we can all relate to being rejected and
obsessed.
Yeah, on both ends, I think.
We're, for sure.
Yeah. So how disturbing would it be for someone to turn around and start stalking you and obsessing? Maybe even capturing you, cutting off of your eyes, your tongue, and making you eat out of a dog dish while your legs are broken.
That's strangely specific.
Yeah.
Is that from a movie or
it's from
real
Audition.
Life? Oh, okay.
So... Yeah, there's always the chance that someone's gonna lose their shit because you played with the emotions of the wrong person.
So there's so many obsession horrors. Yeah. Well, we're watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend right now because season 3 was just released on Netflix, which made me very excited.
Not horror.
And no, it's very funny.
Not at all.
Well, typically it's very funny. This last episode was kind of sad, but she refers to Swim Fan, which is actually an obsession horror that I have seen.
Yes.
Where an unrequited love goes terribly wrong. And the girl who has her heart broken tries to murder her love interest. Mm-hmm.
Go for the director's cut for 20 extra minutes of swimming.
So they worked that in because she's obsessed with her ex-fiance who left her at the altar because he went to become a priest. Spoiler alert. Anyway, so she's reenacting all these creepy scenes.
Yeah.
Like, she's running over to a swing set, pushing the swing, and then running to the bushes. Like, it's real ridiculous.
Being a stalker.
But yeah, like, there's a lot of movies like that that are based around somebody's obsession of unrequited love.
For sure. I think that's a strong way that romance can merge well with horror.
Yeah, and it is
strengthening
really
it.
Terrifying to think, hey, if I reject this person, are they going to go away? Or are they going to make a doll out of my hair?
Now, obviously, there are movies like Practical Magic and Vamps with Alicia Silverstone, which have spoopy aspects. They're
romantic comedies,
right?
Though,
with like spooky things, spooky things, yeah. But they're not scary at all. The romance there does not help the horror.
Well, it's like Twilight. That is not a horror movie, but there are werewolves and vampires in it.
Yeah, and the romance there does not help the horror.
No,
because essentially it's not meant to be a horror movie.
Right, right.
But yeah, I think we gave some good examples of movies that are horror that can be strengthened with romance. So I think that goes to say that if you are a horror fan, which if you're listening to this, I hope you are, then, you know, you can accept romance because it has a place in horror. You can accept love. And
you can accept romance gone terribly wrong.
You don't have to. You don't have to be, a stereotype. You don't have to go walking through the woods with a knife.
You can watch Practical Magic. It's not going to ruin your cred.
You don't have to go out and start summoning demons. You don't have to start invading people's dreams and making them experience their worst nightmares. Take off the glove with the razor blade fingers. Drop the machete. Just step out of the bushes and find someone that you can hold a hand with.
Like those little mittens for two hands.
Yeah.
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 Drop the razor blade.
Because horror and romance can exist together is what I'm saying. Yeah, let's go ahead and kick on into our crumb section.
All right.
All right.
Bon appetit, bitch.
All right, so I'm going to read a couple of stories from you, and
this is channeled them into his brain.
Let me start getting my brain working again. I'm going to read a couple of stories to you. These are some tales that I've jotted down that are fish related, and one of them has a cat in it, but it's eating a lot of tuna, so that works. Keep listening if you want to hear some of those stories. Yeah. All right, so the first story is coming to you from a collection of flash fictions that I did, which were all 17th century themed, as if a bunch of different captains throughout the 17th century all had little pieces to contribute to this collection of captain's log entries. This one's about a manta ray, which kind of fits the theme of the Jenny Hanover. All right, so this one's from Captain Thomas, coming at you from May 1st, 1743. I haven't slept in days. My mind plays tricks on me. I see her, a deep silhouette burned into the oak of my cabin wall. Jonah. She calls me Jonah. My ship, crested by the bull, shows no favor to my weakness. Strength lost, I let my body wither among the sight of food. The cook still brings me nourishment, despite my personal neglect. For that I despise him. But the wretched simpleton is all that I have left of us. Any company besides the Phantom is preferable to the alternative, which I fear watches me even now. I knew even as a child I would die here. Dreams. My mother called it a gift. I grew to know better. My first experience with the dreams was at age 5. I stood in shallow water. Flat, long-tailed fish with long fins drifted around my feet in circles. I touch one. It feels like hardened sand upon my soft palm. I raise my head north and see a ship. I know it waits for me. Covered in blood from aft to abaft, with a crew of stilled flesh and a gaping hole below its stern that welcomes me into the void. I pick up one of the skates and hug it to my bare chest as it wriggles in panic. I hold it there against my racing heart. I watch the chasm. I listen to the wind howling through it. I squeeze the fish harder against me. I'm stabbed by its tail. Poisoned. I lay in the water to drown my limbs, and breathing turns still. My eyes fixed upon the sky, away from the crew, I know that I've somehow damned. Jonah. She called me Jonah. As I think of my mother, I leave from the wreckage of the ship and meet the base of the island's rocks, the storm set upon us. I sit here now, staring into the abyss. Fish with flat angel-like fins and a devil's tail swimming just a few feet by the shore. Here comes another Captain's Log entry for you. This one's about the Fiji Mermaid. After the failed mutiny, a mate tells me all the monkeys are dead. I can only thank God. On return from our trip to Jamaica, we picked up our shipment, including 50 monkeys to return home with. We became stranded at sea for 2 weeks after a storm damaged our vessel. Naturally, with provisions running low, the crew became hungry. They knew it was a bad idea, just as I knew marrying my third wife was a bad idea, but hunger motivates men in strange ways. 10 monkeys later, half the crew fell to a Congolese fever. After a few days of the illness, I caught the feverish men who could yet walk in the cargo hold. They claimed the monkeys were cursed and must be killed. When I tried to stop them from shooting the lot of them, they branded me a demon sympathizer and turned their swords on me. My only choice at the moment was to lock them in there with the monkeys just until tempers were cooler. Which brings me to today. Once they had collapsed, the remaining crew members and I bound the sickly mutineers and chained them on deck. We cleaned up what we could of the mess below, steeling ourselves against the monkey brains, blood, and fur splattered like paint below deck. Our only piece of good fortune on this voyage has been a friendly merchant ship which came to our aid, for a price, and helped us make necessary repairs. So, with our cargo destroyed, I'm left with the responsibility of making this disaster at least marginally profitable. I recall meeting with a merchant who sold hideously carved skates as quote-unquote mermaids, so it's given me an idea. I have decided to dry our monkeys and sew them together with the tail of a fish. Perhaps when I return home, I can tell my wife I have a new profession as an artist. With any luck, the shock will kill her. And yet another entry from the captain's log. This is about the Jenny Hanover. The miracle mushrooms I sold as a panacea earned me a few broken bones. The shaved Salvadorans basically shaved rats with trimmed tails that didn't look enough like foreign lapdogs, caused me a few fractures. The sex spices from China brought me the wrath of a score of unrequited lovers and some shattered shins. But this time, I finally done it. Soon, I say soon, my name will be synonymous with Croesus. Note. Find a new doctor for the crew, preferably one that knows how to make more comfortable splints and slings. Last week, I met a half-blind elderly fisherman with one foot in the grave. He carved the likeness of monsters into the dead and dried bodies of skates, giving them the appearance of something otherworldly. The old man said it was a simple hobby he did for the local children and nothing more, so he was quick to sell me all 24 of them for a few coins and some of my blessed barnacle broth, proven to cure blindness half of the time. So, being only half blind, chances were in his favor. The fools won't know what hit their pockets when I introduce and auction the rare, one-of-a-kind, only mermaid yet discovered at each and every port. Of course.
Welcome to Cake Wolf's Kitty Corner, where young listeners like yourself can enjoy some of the spoopiest tales ever told by a cake wolf. Ow! I call this tale Witch's Cat. It's a clever witch's kitten whose curiosity brings her to a chance meeting with the devil herself. So sit back and enjoy the story, and maybe you'll learn why it's always important to be kind to kitties.
As a witch's cat, I get into a little trouble here, with a little of this and a little of that. But trouble is my name, and who could really blame a cat being curious? Why, if that would make you furious, then listen to this tale of when homeless I met the hellish slag. The Christian devil, may she rot 6 foot deep in a bag. Then maybe you'll see how a clever cat can make your life a misery. The devil found me on her porch one night, helpless and cold, mewing in fright. I was terrified by what she wore, a cloak made of cat souls and nothing more. They all came alive and began mewing back at me.
Come join us, Mr. Trouble, and live simply free. There will always be warm milk, and you will sleep on fine silk. No more running from dogs, or eating the garbage of hogs. And late at night, when you're living with your kin, we will all go out and remind hell with sin. Or outside you can stay and wither away, given the choice.
I gave them my voice. I'll join you if you promise me this. One little request of tuna fish bliss. Though, Miss Devil, if not bliss it is I find, those cats you keep are to be free from your hellish bind. And then the devil smiled. Her crooked grin made me feel so defiled. In such a way that I thought at last, this may be my final chance to run away fast. Instead, my paws were pitter-pattering slowly upon the devil's floor unholy.
So, little kitten, what would your eyes have for sight as the choice of your tuna bliss delight?
Said the devil as my moments alive began to waste. Why don't you decide, and I'll give it a taste. And if bliss I decide, well, then to my word I'll abide and give you my hide. So the devil made me tuna fish stuffed in a pear. I took a few bites, and then I did declare, it's not what I thought, for my hide you have not bought. With this poor excuse for tuna fish bliss, is rather instead tuna fish piss. The devil shouted in rage and began making tuna fish stew. I lapped up a few bites and then called it tuna fish poo. The devil was so bitten by anger, fire flew from her eyes as she began to whip up tuna fish pies. More like tuna bliss lies. Then she made tuna fish souffle. Cooking just isn't your forte. Tuna fish omelets. More like tuna fish vomits. Tuna fish cakes. Tuna fish fakes. Then tuna fish and lime. More like tuna fish slime. And so it went on as I got fat. All while the devil screeched like a bat. What a pity to be in the devil's seat. 9 lives last a long time when a cat does nothing but eat. And so it came that on my 3rd life, the devil had not another single recipe. So, without a choice, and from all the yelling, without a voice, she set all the cats free. So, now and again, we all visit her to make one of the devil's deals. To save some more cats, and of course, score some free meals. So, if you come across a stray, don't mistreat her. Keep that in mind. Because if you do, then perhaps Mr. Trouble is what you'll find.
Alright, so those were the stories. I hope you enjoyed them. You're going to have to catch us next time because we're about to get the fuck out of here. You want to contact us in between now and our next show. You can check us out on cakewolf.com where we do Fright Site news. We make cocktails. We write reviews on horror movies and video games and all kinds of stuff. You can follow us on @TweetCakeWolf, which is our Twitter, @KingCakeWolf, which is our Facebook, The Real CakeWolf, which is our Instagram, or you can type in my actual name, Matthew Fishgold. That's like goldfish, but you're swapping the words around. And it's, appropriate to call out my name because this is a fishy episode.
Fishgold.
So you go to Amazon, you type in my name, Matthew Fishgold. You're going to find some books that I've written. So if you liked hearing those stories, you can check out some of my other stuff. We can do free giveaways on there, too, so you might get something free. And also, kingcakewolf@gmail.com is our email. You can write in to us with some horror trivia questions for when we do our horror trivia show. And if you want to write in to us and just let us know how you're doing because you want to let us know that kind of stuff, that's fine too. Or if you want us to cover something specific on the variety show, then go ahead and send us what you would want us to talk about. If we get enough recommendations for anything, someone wants us to talk about a certain movie, a monster, whatever. You got a theme to throw at us. We will put it in one of our variety shows.
Sure. We'll
draw it from a hat and go for it. So that's all I got to throw at you guys.
Yeah.
Anything, last words?
Nope. No last words.
All right.
Going out in silence.
Fish heads.
Get out! Last chance, told you. Get out! Get out!
What is with you guys? How about shutting up for a change, okay? I already fed you.
Beware the moon, lads.
Yeah. What the hell was that all about, huh?